Hey, what's up, everybody? My name is Brian. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety day is June 17th of 2011, and my home group is the Big Easy Group. We meet on Tuesday nights at 7:30 at the corner of South Claiborne and Jefferson. Please come out and visit if you want to experience the best group in town. I'm also the chairperson for this meeting. Will you please join me in a moment of silence followed by the Serenity Prayer? God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things that I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. All right. I would like to tell you what Alcoholics Anonymous is, as stated in our preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who have shared their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and to help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. I've asked Dave to read How It Works from the Big Book.
Hello, family. My name is Dave, and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is August 29th, 2009, and my home group is On the Dot, meets 7 days a week in the mornings. This is how it works. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to the simple program, usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders. But many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. If you've decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. At some of these we balked. We thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. With all the earnestness in our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. Remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, powerful. Without help, it is too much for us. But there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We ask his protection and care with complete abandon. Here are the steps we took which are suggested as a program of recovery. One, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admit to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Many of us exclaimed, "What an order. I can't go through with it." Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. A, that we are alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. C, that God could and would if he were sought. Thank you.
All right, so when Van asked me to host Zach as the the local speaker, my mind just went racing because I realized all the stuff I'd have to do to make him presentable to speak to you guys. I'd have to feed him, I'd have to clothe him, I'd have to bathe him, I'd have to get him here. And every time he's at my house, he already eats all of our food anyways, so. But, you know, I was willing. You know, when you say yes, right? So, no, I say that lovingly. Zach is my sponsor. He has been since almost the first couple weeks of my sobriety. Zach brought me through the steps, which connected me with God, which relieved my obsession for alcohol. He taught me that God has to be between me and the first drink. He showed me that. But he's done so much more than that. He taught me that this program is meant to make me useful to other people, not necessarily to make me feel better, even though I like feeling better. And that it's not about the results. It's about giving and sacrificing my most precious commodity, my time. And Zach has sacrificed a lot of his time for a lot of people, including me. He's been there for me in my darkest moments, crying, not knowing what to do with my life, where I am, who I am. He's been there at the hospital when my son was only a couple hours old, holding him. And I've learned these truths by following his example. So with that, I give you Zach.
Wow. My name's Zach. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is July 11th, 2008. My home group is Neckbreakers. We meet on Monday nights on 1941 Dauphine Street. That's the corner of Dauphine and Turo. There is a parking lot there. We do a lot of exciting things. We have two 10-minute speakers, a coffee break, and then an Ask It Basket on, I think, June 26th. Is that a Monday? June 26th, the last Monday of the month anyway, we're having a speak and meet. And this is something I learned from my sponsor is, once you become a part of a group, whatever the group decides, you support that, regardless of what you may or may not think. That's somewhat difficult for me sometimes. I come back to the group and they tell me, we're having a chili cook-off in June. I come from Iowa. We don't even eat chili in Iowa in June, but it's, you know, this is going to be great, so please, come. Bring chili from your home group. Make the best chili. I challenge you right now. Be there, June 26th. That was very kind. I love Brian. When I first met him, oh, my God. Things happen in Alcoholics Anonymous where you're sitting across the room and you're telling your story and some guy's nodding and then you see him slowly approaching you and you think, oh, God. This guy's going to ask me to sponsor him. And he did. He told me he was a professional snowboarder, that he had a college scholarship to play baseball, and I believe that he was Wiccan. Which, there's nothing wrong with being Wiccan. It's a beautiful religion. Do what's right. Do what's next. But he wasn't Wiccan. He just had a Wiccan ring. And we'd start reading the big book together, and we'd start talking, and he really wanted to teach me all the things that he knew about life and about spiritual experiences. And generally, as most of you know, before we get here, our spiritual experiences come through LSD, or mushrooms. He had a lot of beautiful ideas. And really, I would have bet you dollars to donuts he was not going to stay sober. Probably people here can tell you they would have bet you I wasn't going to stay sober. But what I did is I showed up every week at that treatment center because somebody did that for me. And I met with this guy. And it was surprising because what happened is he started doing all the stuff in the big book. And I saw his life change. I saw this guy who, his plan when he went to treatment was to steal his dad's car while his dad was talking to the counselor and drive back to Ohio. That's a 16-hour drive. This was the best the kid had. He was a degenerate. He stole his dad's refrigerator and then lied about it. You can't, that's hard to get away with. So here's this guy with no hope who's going through all this stuff, and he's doing it. And I see him changing. And I did something in the beginning that really got me hooked up and got me to where I love my sponsor, and I think he loves me. And what it was is we'd do a nightly inventory. And this is after going through the few steps and write down these questions from page 86. And Brian was doing that every night. And what started happening is I'd feel guilty when I wasn't doing mine. And I think that's how this thing works. You know, and then I see this guy who I've told you about his best plans get into a relationship. I think, that's not going to work. And then I see him have a child, and I think, that's not going to work. And then I'm at the hospital, and this little baby is steaming in my hands. And I've been able to see him be a father and be an amazing, you know, man to his woman. Through Alcoholics Anonymous. Through the same stuff somebody else told me. Because before I got here, my problem was not necessarily that I thought Alcoholics Anonymous was stupid or I thought the book was dumb or you all were idiots, which I did. But my biggest problem was that I didn't write it myself. That I didn't come up with it. Because all my life I consider myself a smart guy. Growing up, I grew up in Iowa. And I was one of those guys who I needed to know everything. And if you asked me about something and I didn't know it, I lied about it. I couldn't let you know that I was afraid. I couldn't let you know that I didn't know something because what would you think of me? So I had to prove myself. And the way you prove yourself when you're in Iowa, that day and time, is you fight. You don't show your feelings. You don't talk about any of that. When I was 13 years old, I was at my friend Jeff Witt's house. We found some lime-flavored vodka and Mountain Dew, and we had some Iron Maiden, and it was just the two of us. Oh, man. Have you ever seen lime-flavored vodka and Mountain Dew on your shirt combined with the other things that you've eaten? I mean, both of us. We had it on our shirt, and I had a blast. And it was a beautiful thing. I love getting drunk. I'm not here because I don't like getting drunk. I'm here because I got to a place where I didn't like being sober. Ever. I woke up every morning and I thought, I can't do this anymore. This is horrible. I'm living in another country. I've gotten fired from all the jobs. And I just can't do this anymore. Yet your ideas didn't work. So I get drunk for that time, and I didn't get drunk regularly, but I did whenever I could get it. On Monday morning in school, I was thinking about how are we going to get booze on Friday night. On Friday night, I was getting as much as I could, and I was the guy by the keg pumping the keg. Not because I was altruistic, because I wanted to make sure when that keg started bobbing that we passed around the hat and got more. And I didn't know that was alcoholism. All I knew is that was me having fun. And it was a lot of fun, and it took away all those cares and worries, and it made everything all right. I got to touch Melissa's butt. You know, Melissa would never let me touch her butt without alcohol. And it was magic for her, and it was magic for me, and it was absolutely beautiful, and I couldn't get enough of it. And then on Monday, I'd say, Melissa, do you remember when we were out by that creek? And she'd say, let's not talk about that. So it was this magic elixir. And I got drunk, and I went to college. And I wanted to play football, and I was 17 years old. And I was the big shot, like the gentleman talked about last night. I was the big shot who, all of a sudden, I wasn't the big shot anymore. I was just that new guy. And I drank myself out of that school. I went and followed around bands. I thought I was on a search. I thought I was bohemian. Which Van said means you don't shower and you sleep on your couch of friends. And so I left there, and I was still having fun. Don't get me wrong. I was having a blast. I got to do a lot of things. I got to see a lot of bands. And I went back to that school, though. I was in Omaha, Nebraska, weighing about 150 pounds because I found this magical stuff that helped me to drink without blacking out. And a friend of mine looked at me that I'd grown up with and said, "What has happened to you? You used to be strong. You used to be excited. You look like you haven't slept in 3 days. You look like shit." And it hurt me. Here's my friend telling me this. We don't talk about these things. We talk about chicks and football in Iowa. Maybe wrestling. Unless you're not good at wrestling, then you never talk about wrestling. And he was opening up to me. And it hurt. It struck a wound. And so I went back to school. And I worked out all that spring semester, and I got pretty damn big. And I was a starting member of the football team the next in the fall. And what happened is, like Bill talks about, I had arrived. Now I'm a star on a football team, and I'm still getting drunk. It's no big football team. It's little Division III, but I'm getting drunk, and people are telling me how great I am. And people, teammates, younger guys are saying, "God, I wish I could be like you. You know, you get drunk on Friday night and show up and have 15 tackles on Saturday." And there's shame in that. I finished all of that school. When you're in a city like that, it's a small school, a small city, you get in trouble, and what happens is the police drive you home. Duke drives you home because they know that the college needs to win on Saturday, and you think you can get away with anything, and you think you're pretty special, and people don't really matter because they're just a what can I get from you? What can I get from you? And it's never enough. And I think that's what alcoholism is. It's never enough. If I have this, I want more. If she likes me, I want her to like me. If all of you come up to me and say, "Zach, you did a good job," and this guy says, "You were horrible. I hated you," all I can think about is that one guy who said I was horrible. I don't know why that is. I think deep down, maybe it's alcoholism. I think deep down, it's this sense of separation that I'm different than you, that I'm separate from you. And it's a lie. And the only thing that made that lie not a lie anymore was getting drunk. When I got drunk, I felt connected to everyone. I walk into a bar, I hate everybody there. I have a shot of Jameson and a beer, all of a sudden I love everyone. And then maybe 10 more shots and 10 more beers, I hate everyone again. It's this vicious cycle. When I drank, I couldn't predict who was going to come out. I may be the funniest guy in the world. I may be everybody at the bar loves me. Go home with a beautiful woman. 2 nights later, everybody hates me. I'm breaking glass. I'm trying to fight with people. And I wake up in jail. And I say, "How did this happen?" And this stuff happened over and over and over again. And what I would do is I would get out of jail and I would say to myself, "I'm never going to drink again." And then I'd be walking to the Quickie on Tulane Avenue. And I'd have $14 in my pocket. And I would walk in there with the intention of getting some Winston's and some milk. I meant it. I found out Winston's are stronger than Marlboro Reds. If you still smoke. And I would walk into that store with milk. Winston's. Milk. Winston's. And then I'd walk out with a 24-ounce beer. And it would get that thing started again. And I didn't know I didn't have any control over that thing. I thought I'd just decided to go party. And for 3 or 4 days, I'd be out getting wasted. And I'm the type of guy, when I have romantic notions about drinking, it's not being in a place like this and drinking champagne and having beautiful steak delivered to me. It's being out on the street with the homeless people and yelling at the people walking by, "You're all a bunch of slaves. You're a bunch of idiots. You don't know anything. You're going to work. What is wrong with you?" That's what I like. Oblivion. You know? I got arrested I don't know how many times in New Orleans. That stuff does not make me an alcoholic. People told me, if you just stop doing these things, if you just, you know, get right, if you just stop drinking hard liquor and try beer, you'll be okay. What I do is I go have a water between every drink. Why don't you do that, Zach? And I do that, and I just pee all over the place. I can't, because it's you know, it doesn't help. I have well-meaning people. I worked for a construction guy after Katrina. He loved to drink. He was a good old boy who'd have 5 or 6 beers every day after work. And he'd say to me, Zach, go home after this one. Go home after this one. I'll buy your next one if you go home. Adrian, make sure he goes home, he'd tell the bartender. And I'd tell him, I'm going home after this one. And I meant it. And what happened was this one became this one, became this one, became this one. And I'm stumbling home at 3 in the morning, and I'm up at 7 in the morning because I've got to go work for this guy. I can't control the amount I take. I have no choice once I put the alcohol into my system. So I went to Korea. I was 26 years old. I was moving out to San Diego, California. I didn't realize you couldn't live on $900 in San Diego, California. I didn't have any other money. That $900 was gone in about a week. And a friend said, come on out. And I mean, this was a beautiful... I was in another country for the first time. I had an exotic woman from New Zealand. I loved it. I was running my school. Imagine this. I am in charge of 3 other teachers. I'm the head teacher. And these other 3 teachers, my brother, who's actually in jail right now, and 2 of my friends who worked at a restaurant with me. None of these guys have college degrees, and I'm in charge. The director made the mistake of the first night I was there saying, I'm going to pay for this. You drink whatever you want. We drank every beer in the restaurant and had to start going to soju. You know? I'm wandering around a country where drunken old men are holding hands like this, and I'm the one getting kicked out of bars. I can't even speak the language. Just my actions are you need to go. And at that time, there was something in me, since the beginning there's been something in me that knew I need to stop this, I need to do something. But whenever I would stop, whether I was in Korea, wherever I was, what would happen is, what are you going to do? I've always considered myself a creative. I've written all my life. And so here's the thing. With alcohol, I have a problem. I drink alcohol, it's gone. With sobriety, I stopped drinking alcohol. I have a huge problem. And I think it's going to be fixed if I can just publish this short story. If I can just get her. If I can leave this country and go to this country. If I can get another job. And I think these things are going to be immediate. And it's not that way with sobriety. It's a journey. You know? I left South Korea. And I didn't want to live in the United States anymore. So in January of 2004, I came to New Orleans. And what a beautiful place for a drunk and for a sober drunk. If you come to me and say, I can't find any sponsees, I'm guessing you've locked yourself in your closet and haven't left for 3 or 4 days. They're everywhere. They are all over these streets. They're seeping. They're oozing. They're dying. And I loved them. I had so much fun with these drunks in New Orleans. You're in the French Quarter. It is not abnormal to start drinking at 9 o'clock on a Monday morning or a Tuesday or a Wednesday. And it's just, you know, it's a place of ultimate freedom. And you believe it's free. And it's normal. And so what happens is I'm going in and out of jail in New Orleans. And I'd been to some AA meetings before. At this time, I'm 30 years old. I'd been to some AA meetings when I was 23. I was attracted to them. I was attracted to the stories. There was a guy who had a couple girlfriends and he ran drugs. That was a neat story. You know? There was a guy who was in Chicago and he played a horn and he pawned his horn and he, you know, these are great stories. Johnny T said something interesting last night about when he was on fire, or I'm guessing he still is on fire. I can't be that loud. But he wanted to go around and make all the meetings big book study meetings. I have a different idea. I think all the meetings should be speaker meetings because I think that's what we have. The big book saved my life, but what got me into the big book was the story of another alcoholic. A lot of stories of a lot of alcoholics. That's what we have. You look at any way back, any religion, anything, lessons are told through stories. They aren't told by you do this and you do that, and if you don't do this, you're going to die. They're told through stories. And my heart opened when another guy opened his heart to me. I don't know how I got from jail to there, but let's go back to jail. So I start going to these meetings. Because I was young. And I thought it was stupid. And from 23 to 30, I told people I went to Alcoholics Anonymous. Those people don't know what they're talking about. I tried Alcoholics Anonymous, and it doesn't work. The truth was I didn't try Alcoholics Anonymous. I tried your cigarettes. I tried your coffee. I tried to try your women. They weren't always receptive. But at 30 years old, I was in New Orleans, and I was pretty damn depressed. I was going down pretty quickly. And I was living in a house that they told me I didn't have to pay rent for a month if I took out the old floors and put in the new ones. And I took out the old floors. And then I slept in the bathtub for a couple weeks. And it's nasty, and there's mosquitoes. And so I start going to AA meetings, and I go to AA meetings on Central Avenue in Metairie because I'm embarrassed that I might see people that I know from New Orleans. This is the same guy who at 6 in the morning is yelling at people, calling them slaves for going to work. And what I'm embarrassed about is that I had to ask for help. That's what I'm embarrassed about. And guys reached out to me. You know, I did 10 years ago. I did a third step in the middle of the hood on my knees with all my neighbors watching. And then I wrote half of a fourth step. And then I got drunk for another 6 months. I ended up in Prague teaching students there. I was drunk for 7 months straight. And I walked up to the window a number of times. And it said the meeting is at noon, and the next meeting's at 6. And every day I went there at 12:30. And one day an Irish guy came out and said, "Why don't you come in here?" And so I sat in that meeting, and I didn't say anything. Because what I'd done before at AA meetings is I'd expounded my wisdom, whatever latest book I was reading. I was fond of electric Kool-Aid acid tests, so I'd quote that and other ones. And I shut up. Part of it was because I didn't know what to do anymore. Part of it was I wanted you to think I was mysterious. And a guy came up to me and he said, "Why don't you stay a little bit after the meeting?" I said, "All right." And we talked, and he told me some of his stories. What attracted me to this guy is he was a heroin addict whose alcoholism just went to heroin. He just found a bunch of powdered alcohol. But he had what I had. Once he started drinking, he couldn't stop. when he tried to quit, he couldn't stay quit. And what he told me was that he would, despite being vegan, that means you don't eat eggs or meat or any kind of fish, none of that. But he would share needles with people that he didn't know that he met in an alley. This made sense to me. He also told me when he was 22 years old, he went into a psychiatrist's office and she was beautiful. She had degrees on the wall. She had all these things. She was in a nice suit. And he started talking to her and she started responding and he thought, I think she wants me. I could relate to that insanity. I was just telling this guy before the meeting, I was at a 4 a.m. meeting in New Orleans when I was trying to get sober, and I shared my guts. I shared the truth all about everything. And this woman from New York starts crying. It's a convention. And I think she wants me. I've got her. Because that's all I use these stories for. I use stories to intimidate you, to impress you, to get in your good graces, any of it. This guy said, why don't we read this book together? I said, oh, contraire, mon frère. You don't understand. I've already read this book a number of times. I use this book as a roach holder. I would put my roaches from my joints in there to mark the pages so that hopefully someday I'd be so desperate I'd be going to get high and something would happen and I just... What used to be the something, the hauncher, gradually became a working part of it. I don't know. But for some reason, I said yes. And we started going through that book together. And what happened, I already said, I think, something of the effect that it's not so much the book. It's what the book can do, how it can transform your life. And I think more of what was happening is it was the first time in my life that I asked somebody for help. I asked somebody for help a number of times and meant it. But it was the first time in my life I asked for help, I meant it, and then I just said yes. And then I just said, what next? And then I just said, I don't know what I said, but it was some kind of I was supplicating. I just did everything because I was done. I had a full realization, I can't do this anymore. I can't do it. We got to the fourth step, and I started writing all these resentments. And he kind of tricked me. He said, I want you to write down all the names. And I wrote down all the names. Okay, now I want you to write down why you resent all those people. I'm thinking, all right, I'm about done. Now I want you to write down, you know, these seven parts of self that it affects. And I'm like, all right, now I'm done? No. We haven't even gotten to the real stuff. See, when I got through with those resentments, I had about this much of an ability to realize that every problem I have ever had, I am a huge part of. And also, what I've since realized even more and more and more, when I resent somebody, when I have a problem with somebody, it's either because I'm deeply afraid of something. It's always because I'm deeply afraid of something. But even more, I'm looking at myself. You are never the person making me angry. You are the mirror that allows me to change. Think about that. It's a horrible thing to think about. You don't get to be resentful anymore very long. My beautiful, wonderful, amazing girlfriend told me yesterday that she was going to put grass on her lawn. I think that's a horrible thing. I think trees and things should be planted and grass is a horrible crop. In my mind, that went to, she doesn't respect me. How selfish can she be? Then it went to, what have I even gotten myself into? I'm with a woman that believes in grass. This is how quickly my mind goes to, and I'm out. The difference is, I didn't say, this is ridiculous, I'm out of here, baby. I said, I love you, I'm going to talk to you later. right? I pause when agitated or doubtful because it's never real. He starts taking me through the book. I'm on an island in Prague. It's beautiful. The castle is in the background, Hradčanska, and I'm writing my inventory. And there's people going by on paddle boats, and they're drinking, I don't know what, they're drinking Staropramen, and they're smoking joints. And one moment I'm thinking, thank God I'm not those horrible people. And the next moment I'm thinking, God, I just want a joint and I want a drink. And But I was doing it. I was doing it. I was writing. I was becoming a member of something that before that I had just been sitting and taking up space and wanting you all to fix me and wanting to come and tell you all my problems so that maybe you could get me a lawyer. That's what I thought AA was. And I kept going and I kept writing that stuff. And what happened was that sponsor gave me a week to finish. And it took me 11 days because if you haven't noticed, I'm rather verbose. It was long. I just kept writing and writing and writing. You don't need to write as much as I did. But it took me 11 days. And that was writing 1 hour every day. And that was with a crazy man who thinks he needs to publish a novel. Okay? A four-step doesn't take that long to write. He left the country. And I realized that I either had this guy, Michael Brewer, or this other guy who was English. This English guy had 10 years. Michael had 5 months. And these people, see, they'd tricked me. They'd had me show up early for the meeting. They'd have me make people, they have tea over there. And they'd have me make espressos at this Friday night meeting. That was my job. And I thought they were taking advantage of me. And they would have me, when people came to visit, I would walk those people all around Prague. As long as they wanted. Because I didn't sleep. I just walked the people around and I did stuff and I told them things. And I was doing something for other people. And I look back on it and I really think the reason I chose this guy, who's still sober and has some children over there and things are great, is I felt like it would help him. This guy had done dozens of fifth steps. This guy hadn't done one. Also, if I'm brutally honest, he might not be as harsh a critic as this guy. I thought maybe, I thought they were going to whip me. I thought they were going to, oh my God, you did what? You touched her where? Oh God. Like, this is what I thought was going to happen. And what happened is, as I'm saying these things to this guy that I think are horrible, he's saying, yeah, me too. I told this guy that a woman in my writing class, I was drunk, asked me how she could be a better writer. And at the time I thought, you need to suffer. You want to be a writer, you need to suffer. That's what Hemingway said, right? That's what a tough Iowa boy says. And I said she hadn't suffered enough, and if she was beaten or raped, it would make her writing better. This is who I become when alcohol is in my system. It's a horrible thing. Horrible, horrible thing. And he told me some horrible things that he'd done. And although it didn't change what had happened, I got a little bit freer. Because most of what happens, I see, is people sit around with secrets. If there's a problem of separation and that's the ultimate problem, I will never be in communion with you when I'm holding on to a secret. Because I'm different. No matter what you say or do, I am different. Because you don't understand. Because I can't tell you this, and I can't tell you that, and I can't tell you this. I got back to... I made some amends. I was teaching kids over there. And like I said, you would have loved me as a teacher. We smoked joints by the river and played hacky sack and drank beer, and I couldn't show up for that job anymore. That's how screwed up I was. I made amends to those people. I didn't do a formal amends. I went and bought them all pizza. And I told him, I'm sorry that I've let you down. And I'm sorry that your new teacher is a shithead who doesn't let you smoke weed. And, you know, it was kind of the beginning. And then I went around and made amends to the places I was working for, the schools that I was working for, that I was stacking jobs on top of each other and not going to either of them and getting paid. I went and made amends to them. And then I went and made amends to everybody. And I called my sponsor, who was in the States, and he said, slow down, man. Are you the Jesse James of amends? What are you doing? And what he meant was not slow down, but to talk to him first before I did this. And thank God I did. And so I get back to the United States, and I'm about 2 months sober, and I'm lit up. For the first time in my life, something's different, and I'm excited. And I get to Iowa, and I'm going to meetings there, and my sponsor's on the phone telling me, you need to find some sponsees. You're going to die if you don't find sponsees. And I'm going to meetings, and I'm trying to find sponsees, and people are telling me, you only have 2.5 months. You can't sponsor anyone. And see, he had taken me through the big book. He'd armed me with not just facts and knowledge about himself and myself, but about the history of Alcoholics Anonymous, about the fact that Ebbie Thatcher was, what, 6 weeks sober when he went and carried the message to Bill Wilson? That Dr. Bob was 16 days when they went and saw Bill Dotson in the hospital? That what they said to Bill Dotson, the third man on the bed, was, all right, you've done this after a week, now go out there and give it away to someone who wants it and needs it badly. I knew all this stuff, but I didn't have my army behind me. And I started thinking, screw these people. They don't know how to do AA correctly in Iowa. And I got high for 3 days. It was just little stuff. And I come back down to New Orleans, and I'm a month and a half sober, and I'm, oh, man. Nobody in New Orleans was doing it right either. It's true. 2008, I was going to meetings and letting them know they weren't doing it right. And then I ran into some guys, and they were talking the same kind of stuff that these people in Prague were talking. And what I realized they were talking was Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know. I thought the meetings kind of were Alcoholics Anonymous. And we started running around. And I asked this. There were three guys who came up to me, and this one guy was sober longer, and he had a big beard and an accent. And I just followed him around because I didn't, he was kind of intimidating, and I didn't want to ask questions that would make him think I was stupid, like, where are we going? Or, when am I going to be home? So I just went. And the beauty of it, like, these are the most beautiful memories. I was just talking to a guy in a treatment center, and I said, man, you don't know how good you have it. You're sitting out there with hundreds of alcoholics. Stop looking at them as people you think are bothering you and look at them as God's grace and an opportunity to change your life, and your life will change. I think I just said it a little more eloquently than I said it to him, but I started going with this guy, and I got a home group, and I became a part of that home group, and these guys, Brent and Sean, were there, and it was 7 or 10 people. And what was beautiful about it is what we were doing is all of us were talking about sponsorship. And the meetings I had been to before that, when I heard somebody talking about sponsorship, you know what they were talking about? Well, I got to call my sponsor every day, and I got to check in with my sponsor. And I stopped calling my sponsor, and I stopped going to meetings, and I got drunk. And what I learned was, if this is all I'm doing, I am going to get drunk. Or I'm going to get very discontented and maybe eat a lot. Or watch a lot of porn. Or smoke a lot. And so I'm kind of I can be combatant. So I would go around to people who said that about I stopped calling my sponsor, I stopped going to meetings, and I relapsed, and I would ask them, what did you do with all your sponsees? Oh, they don't like that question. They don't. So I fell in, kind of hook, line, and sinker. And I started going out to a place called Gateway on the West Bank at the recommendation of my sponsor. I was about a month and a half, 2 months sober. And these guys out there were crazy enough to think that I knew things. And they let me help them. They really did. And I knew everything. I was 3 months sober, and I knew everything. I started making a list for the home group. I go out here on Tuesday and Thursday. Here's the list of when I'm going out to the treatment center. I need you guys to fill in the other days. That's what I'm telling these guys who have, 10, 6, 4 years. You guys need to keep up with me. And I had this piece of crap van called a Van Burgini. It had a green door on one side, and it was gold, and it was an old Aerostar. And I filled that thing with alcoholics. And we would listen to a speaker tape on the way to the meeting, and they'd be drunk most of the time, and it was great. They loved that. And then on the way back, they'd be sober. And then sometimes we'd just talk. And I'd complain about these guys, and I'd say things like, none of them want to stay sober. Why am I going out there? I say, we don't go to those places because they're alcoholic. We go because we're alcoholic. And what happened is some of those guys I fell in love with. There's a guy named Richard V. who the first time we were just reading, or I might have made the mistake of saying God, the word. And I thought he was going to bite my head off. This guy was a gunner, a helicopter. He shot people down in Vietnam. There is no God when you shoot people down in Vietnam. Sorry. 7 years later, that guy's working for the VA and helping people. He learned how to do that in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm driving back and forth, and part of it is I've got to impress these guys. See, because that's who I am. I need you to like me so that I'll be okay. And so I'm rolling up to Big Easy, and I've got the Lamborghini, and I've got, 8 overweight veterans in there, and it's sunk down. And what I do is I pull up to the side, and the door is right up here, but I pull up to the side so you can see my humility. I'm letting these guys out so they can walk up first. Then I'm going to go park about 2 or 3 blocks away and walk on my own. Generous, loving, humble. Here's the beauty of all of that. The action does not care why it's taken. The action does not care why it's taken. If I do good things for human beings to impress you, it doesn't matter. And what started to happen is the more people I started doing this for, the more my heart opened, and the more I started to love. How much time do I have? 6 minutes. I told you about all of that fighting and all of those horrible things, and that's how we grew up. And I'd like to tell a couple of men's stories and leave you all alone. The first one is that woman I said the horrible things to. She was on my list. And when I wrote a list, I think it was now, later, never. She might have been on the never, I don't remember. But that woman ended up publishing a book and was going to do a reading in Baton Rouge, which, as you all know, is near here, an hour away. And I was driving a limousine at the time. And what I decided was, if I'm not working on Saturday night, I'll go to her reading and I'll make amends to her. If any of you have ever worked in the service industry, you know you always work on Saturday nights. I'm like, oh, it's God's will. That is such a cop-out sometimes. People say it's God's will. I'm not going to do anything. It's God's will. I want a peanut butter and jelly sandwich.
Get the bread.
So I don't do it. The next day, I'm in between shifts at the limo job. I'm at a coffee shop called the Bean Gallery, right there. In walks her and a friend of hers. Her name was Jen, is Jen. And I think, I can't do it when she's with this woman. It would be selfish. God says, bathroom for Casey. And so I walk up to Jen and I say, Jen, I said some things to you that no human being should ever say to another human being. You have never done anything but treat me with kindness, which is true. She was a sweet gal. You have never done anything but treat me with kindness. That was wrong. And is there anything I can do to make it right? And I kid you not, what happened was something between us just went, whoosh, fell. Just right there, I felt it, and she felt it. And she looked right at me, and she said, you just did. Now, here's what happens without Alcoholics Anonymous. Without Alcoholics Anonymous, I go around getting drunk and telling people, that woman can't write. She doesn't know anything. She doesn't know this. She doesn't know that. And the reason is because I'm terrified to find out who I am, to find out what is underneath all that crap. And so to survive, I have to judge you. I have to make myself better than you. And what happens is when you sit down with another man, that goes away. It goes away. You're connected. And that's God. That's all. People, I don't know who and what God is. It would be hubris for me to stand up here and say, this is what God is. I know God's not me. I know God's available in all of you and in me. So, what has Alcoholics Anonymous given me? I lived in a storeroom with sawhorses and power tools. I would burn my leg on the little heating pipe when I first got sober. And I look back on it, and that was a beautiful beginning. I was running around, all I had to do was Alcoholics Anonymous. I told that guy in the treatment center, remember that you have all these people around you that will change your life. Because now I'm a very busy man. And even sometimes it's not just in here. You know? I have a house that I own. I have a woman that does not need me. Really, she doesn't. She'll tell you. She doesn't. Sometimes I even try to fix things with her that she doesn't know are wrong. And she's all right without me trying to fix it. All my life, I found somebody who would kind of let me fix them. Because I couldn't fix myself. I still can't fix myself. From a trembling, despairing, nervous wreck emerged a man brimming over with self-contentment. Wait, self-contentment? Self-reliance and contentment. That's what the doctor sees. But I don't think that's the truth. Self-reliance never worked, and it still does not work for me today. I wake up in the morning, my mind is going crazy. I'm never going to get this. I'm never going to get that. I didn't eat. Should I eat? Did I eat? Maybe I should eat. Maybe I should do the dishes. Maybe. And then what happens is I pray and I meditate. And when I sit in silence, and thank you for the gentleman who did that this morning, that was beautiful. When I sit in silence, what happens is all the thoughts that I think are real are just thoughts. And it's saved my life. And I want to thank some of my best friends are here. You know, some of my very best friends, people that I love, are here. And those of you that I don't know, I love you too. And just thank you for listening. And I'm glad I'm done.
Thank you very much, Zach. Thank you for coming to share your story with us. We would like to present you with this gift as a token of the Big Deep South Convention Committee's appreciation. I'll turn the meeting back over to Lisa. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Zach. That was wonderful. And thank you, everyone, for waking up early and coming out. Just to let you guys know, if you haven't had a chance to look at your agenda, itinerary, we have our Al-Anon speaker at 11, which is Vinoy in this room. So please come out. Hospitality room reopens from 11 to 2. It's on the 16th floor. At 12:30, we have an AA workshop, which is going to be fabulous, about the four absolutes. And then we have a wonderful AA speaker at 2, Adele, who's right here in the front row. Another workshop at 3:30 to 5, Healing the Spiritual Malady. And an Al-Anon workshop, which is also going to be awesome. Vinoy asked that you bring your big book, even though, yeah, it's Al-Anon. And then everything begins tonight at 7. So now we get to close with the Lord's Prayer.